And this is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Teach the Children Well, the Battle for Public Education, featuring Diane Ravitch.
Governor Cuomo manipulated the state budget, holding up its passage until it included the hugely unpopular and anti-worker practice of pegging teachers' tenure and evaluations to standardized test grade results. While dropped from inclusion in the budget, the governor's desire to see the proliferation of charter schools remains a mainstay in his education agenda. These issues have been heating up ever since President Bush's No Child Left Behind plan, but especially since the rollout of Race to the Top and the Common Core state standards. So, Building Bridges decided to tackle these issues with Diane Ravitch.
Who infuses research about the recent history of education policy reform, the strategies used for fighting back against these policies, and who proposes solutions that work to create sustainable, equitable, anti-racist, democratic, and meaningful public education. Our conversation with Diane Ravitch is for anyone interested in an insider's look and a leading resistance or forming an organization towards reclaiming our public schools and reclaiming the public narrative around education policy.
And it's nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much. I am enjoying being with you.
Well, let's begin with Governor Cuomo's, your thoughts on exactly that, the fact that he held up the state budget and manipulated it until he could peg teachers' tenure and the evaluations to standardized testing results. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's absolutely terrible because it's very clear from what all the different scholarly organizations have said that you can't judge teacher quality by test scores. It ends up that the teachers who teach the most difficult and most challenging students get low ratings. And they're penalized because they're teaching English language learners. They're penalized because they're teaching students with disabilities. Even teachers of the gifted are penalized because their students are already at the top. They have no place to go. So it turns out that these rating systems are judging teachers by test scores, and they're really judging them by who they teach, not whether they're good teachers. What was also really obnoxious about Cuomo's proposal, which was that 50% of a teacher's evaluation would depend on test scores, 35% would depend on the judgment of an independent evaluator, and only 15% the principal in the building. So he's never explained this. Who would be these independent evaluators who've never seen the teacher, who come into the building, look at the teacher, maybe they spend 15 minutes in his or her classroom, and then they leave and they say, you know, that's 35% of a teacher's evaluation. Does this mean that New York State will be hiring thousands and thousands of people to do these independent evaluations? And they can't be valid because how can you just sit in someone's classroom once and say whether or not they're a good teacher? You know, there's so much wrong with this, one hardly knows where to begin. A lot of what he has advocated for, especially the charter school part, is promoted by the hedge fund managers who've given him millions of dollars. They also want to have tough teacher evaluations because they want to see teachers fired. But it creates a reign of terror for teachers, and it's very demoralizing.
Your last book was Reign of Error. I guess this is Governor Cuomo's, or King Cuomo's, New York State's reign of error. I wanted to pursue it a bit further. I know that the head of NYSERT, the New York State United Teachers, is contemplating a campaign to have the parents withdraw their children from high-stakes testing. Tell us about what the possibilities of that are.
Well, Karen McGee, who's the head of the New York State United Teachers, made a statement, and she said that in light of the governor's wish to demoralize and demonize teachers, the best thing that parents could do to protect their children and to protect their schools and to protect their teachers was refuse the test. I saw Karen McGee at a meeting in Westchester about 10 days ago, and at that point she had not committed herself to this course of action, but no one knew where Cuomo's policies would end up. Now we know. Now we know that he is definitely a promoter of charter schools. He is definitely not interested in fully funding the schools. I mean, New York State has one of the most inequitably funded school systems in the country. There are suburban districts that where they spend almost $25,000 a student, and then there are poor districts where it's $12,000 a student. And that's wrong. And Governor Cuomo has been urged repeatedly to fully fund the schools, to comply with the court order and a court case called the Campaign for Fiscal Equity. And he keeps saying, we don't want to throw money at the schools. Well, I'm sure that if he lives in a suburban community, that a lot of money is being thrown where his kids are going to school.
Diane Ravitch, I recently heard Eva Moskowitz speak, who is a champion of the charter school movement and has clearly some aspirations in a future mayoral race. But her statement around the hedge funds in general were, so what? Corporations have long had philanthropic issues. There's the Gates Foundation. There are many others. So why should it concern us that hedge funds may be supporting a school movement? And then we'll tackle the substantive issues around charter schools. But how do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think it's a so what issue. What we're seeing, and it's happening all over the country, is a movement to privatize public education. And if you think that it's a good thing to privatize the public schools, you need only look at Chile or Colombia to see where it ends up, which is tremendous racial segregation, economic segregation, social segregation, and the destruction of public education. And public education has always been a great equalizer in this society. It's a place where people from different backgrounds mingle. We have been going backwards over the last 20 years where segregation is on the rise because, frankly, federal government doesn't care about it anymore. They have backed off from lawsuits. We have very conservative courts. And one of the things that we know really makes a difference in terms of the achievement of Black and Hispanic kids is being in an integrated school, and it makes a lifelong difference. But this is something that the government just doesn't want to tackle anymore. And the charter schools exacerbate segregation. They make segregation worse. And the charter schools in general have been criticized by the UCLA Civil Rights Project for intensifying segregation. So I guess that Eva Moskowitz would say it doesn't matter because her kids get high scores. But I think that in a democratic society, we have to worry about all the kids and not just the few that she takes in her schools.
But are you suggesting also that inherently that privatization is on the mind of the hedge funds and that's the basis for and motivation for their funding of the schools?
I don't think there's any question that what's on their minds is privatization. They may have other language to describe it, but when you take the money away from the democratic control and you vest it in a private board of directors, many of whom are hedge funders and equity investors, and then you open up the education sector for monetizing the schools, that's privatization. And unfortunately, a lot of this is being promoted by the federal government and by the Gates Foundation, and they've made a number of statements, and I'm thinking here of both Bill Gates and Arne Duncan, that says that innovation comes from the private sector. And so they do want to have equity investors. They want the hedge fund people to invest in businesses. I mean, Rupert Murdoch is one of the big investors in education and education technology. And it's if you look around, there was an article in The Nation a couple of weeks ago by George Joseph about 9 billionaires who want to remake education in New York State. And it's not because they want to make money. It's because they think that the private sector and the desire to make money creates innovation. And it actually doesn't, whether it creates innovation or not, what it does is it incentivizes the people running the schools to pay the lowest possible wages, to have a high turnover of teachers, to get rid of experienced teachers and veteran teachers because they cost too much. And I just don't understand how anyone can think that makes education better to turn it over to recent college graduates and to have have them work 60, 70 hours a week, no unions. That's also part of the business plan. And I don't see this as improving education, but as privatizing it.
You wrote an article for Huffington Post, I think it was about a year ago, in which you tore apart Eva Moskowitz's use of statistics in terms of her saying that she had such great test scores compared to everybody else. Tell us exactly how she basically convoluted the whole thing. She's a great PR person for herself, but I just can't see that anybody else besides you challenged her.
Was this about the Success Academy?
Yeah.
Right. Well, the question is not, does she have good test scores? Her schools do have good test scores, but the question is, how do they get good test scores? They get good test scores by a series of selection mechanisms. The first selection mechanism is the lottery. And we know that many families don't even know there is a lottery, so you immediately screen out the unmotivated families, and you're only appealing to those who are informed, motivated, et cetera. And then after the lottery, certain kids are discouraged from entering the school. Eva Moskowitz's schools have very few kids with serious disabilities, and those kids are then in the local public school, which has more kids with disabilities because Eva Moskowitz's school has very few, if any. Her schools have very few English language learners. So when she talks about having kids with disabilities, they'll be the mildest kind of disabilities. The kids maybe with a speech impairment or a hearing issue, but the kids who are in wheelchairs and have very, very serious cognitive issues, they're not in her school. So to compare her school to public schools, you're talking about oranges and apples. But the other thing that Eva does that's different is, and she admits that this is the case, is she's introduced a new word into the vocabulary. Her schools do not backfill. What that means is that she'll start off with a class, and if a child arrives and wants to join the school and it's fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, they say no. They do not add kids, and she says, well, we want to maintain our culture. Well, their culture is not having kids with disabilities, not having kids who are English language learners, and not accepting kids in mid-year or at the beginning of the year who weren't in the school last year. So she may start with 100 kids and end up with 50 or 40 or 32. And I think that it's, you know, I don't know what goes on in her schools, but I can only say that she does get high test scores, and the secret is attrition.
Diane, if indeed there are some quality advantages that can help raise the test scores, et cetera, within the charter schools, certainly then it's understandable that parents would seek to enroll their children in them. Is there a fundamental conceptual problem with that issue, even if there is some relative betterment educationally, and I'm not sure at all that there is, maybe you can debunk that as well, within the charter schools? What's wrong with that conceptually?
Well, conceptually, we are trending toward the dual school system. We have two publicly funded systems. One is allowed to choose its students, to remove the students it doesn't want, and the other has to take everyone. And so, of course, a parent would say, well, sure, I'd like to have my child in the school where all the disruptive kids are kicked out, where there are no kids with serious disabilities, and where it's just the kids who are strivers, who are highly motivated. The problem is that you then overload the other system, the one where the great majority of kids go, with the kids who've been kicked out of the charter schools. And in some way, it strikes me that we are returning to almost pre-Brown versus Board of Education. And whereas the segregation at that time was based on race, it's now largely based on disability, on English language status, on behavior. And it's social, it's economic, and it creates, for many kids, this kind of exclusive environment with public money, and enables many kids, many families to say, well, why should I send my children to private school? I'm just going to enroll in a charter school. We're talking about very small numbers of kids. We're talking in New York City about 10% of the kids. New York State, we're talking about 3% of the children. So I think back to, I guess it was 2012, when Governor Cuomo said, I'm going to be the student's lobbyist. We didn't realize when he said that, that he really meant to be the charter student's lobbyist, representing 3% of the children. But who's representing the other 97%? I'm not sure.
And now we have a push by certain interest groups to do private schools with state funding of that, which didn't get into the budget, but is still possibly alive for later in the legislative session.
Sure. Well, that's something that is actually a voucher. And there are about 20 states that have some form of tax credit. And it's a way in which people can make a contribution and get a very large tax credit for it. And it's not really just about families. It's also about corporations. And they're able then to divert funding that should have gone to public schools to religious and private schools. Now, the problem with that is twofold. One is that New York State has a specific constitutional prohibition against public money going to religious schools. It's called the Blaine Amendment or the Little Blaine Amendment. There are many states that have that prohibition, and the courts have just ignored it. There are Pennsylvania, Florida, all of these states have specific constitutional amendments saying you can't do this, and they're doing it anyway, and they're getting away with it. And so there are now almost half the states with some form of voucher and sending public money to religious schools. I said there were two problems. One problem is that it violates the state constitution and no one seems to care. And the other problem is that the kids who go to voucher schools don't do any better. I mean, there have now been, we have three cities with vouchers, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and the District of Columbia. There's been no improvement of the kids in the voucher schools. They've been evaluated, and all the evaluations show that it doesn't make any difference in terms of their achievement.
Well, you have certainly stressed in your writings, et cetera, that really poverty is the underlying cause, I believe, of problems with American education. I know that you don't seem to have any intention in that direction, but the last time I saw Mr. de Blasio in my local meat market before he moved up to the east side, I suggested that you actually be made the Commissioner of Education. While that is not to be the case at this moment, I'd like to at least give you the opportunity, at least we just act in a critical mode, to reshape an education agenda. What would you do to make our schools, our public schools, live up to the promise that they hold?
Well, the most important thing to recognize is what you said a few minutes ago, which is that poverty is the biggest cause of low school performance. And I've written about this extensively in my last book. I devoted two chapters to the effects of poverty. When you consider that children who are poor are less likely to have medical care, more likely to be absent from school because they're sick, more likely to live in substandard housing, more likely to experience violence in their own in their presence. The things they're less likely to have the advantages and more likely to have all the disadvantages that come with having economic insecurity. And of course, it affects their life. And one of the things that it, most obnoxious things of these people who call themselves reformers is that any mention of poverty is making excuses. Well, that's like saying I don't believe the sun rises in the east. I mean, it's just and sets in the west. It's simply a fact. It's been proven again and again. Every standardized test has an achievement gap based on economics. The most affluent kids cluster at the top, and the poorest kids cluster at the bottom. That's true of state tests, national tests, international tests, the ACT, the college board exams. They all show the same pattern of the correlation between affluence and high scores, poverty, and low scores. And there are some kids who defy that through sheer determination and talent and brilliance, but they're the outliers. The overwhelming finding in all testing research is that test scores, especially standardized test scores, are a reflection of economics. Lonnie Guinier, in her most recent book, refers to the SAT as a family wealth index, and I think that's about right. So I think what we have to do everything possible to improve schools. I mean, what struck me as I've traveled around the country is frequently I've gone into suburban schools and been simply absolutely blown away by the beauty of the facilities. And, you know, they're just gorgeous because this belongs to that community and that community invests in its children. And then you go into many city schools and you think, God, you know, this is almost like a prison. And why didn't they hire a wonderful architect to design a beautiful space? Why is everything so decrepit? But we have not been able, as a society, to make that commitment, unless you're in an affluent community, in which case people say, these are our children. And in the cities, the people with the money, the people who are on Wall Street, these are not their children, so they don't want to pay the taxes to provide beautiful schools. But the most important point is that the kids who are poor, we should be thinking about the policies that would reduce poverty. And you can talk about this program or that program, but if they don't affect the economic existence of that family's life, then ultimately you're still pushing that big rock uphill. And so I'd say the most important thing that the mayor could do, that the president could do, would be to economic development that creates jobs for people who are now jobless. And that would be a huge educational improvement program, is to make sure that families have the means to have a decent life.
And to return to the note at which we started the program, which was the state budget, a few years back there was a campaign for fiscal equity of funding poor schools and poor neighborhoods, and which won in the courts, but was never implemented. Does the state budget, which was agreed to today, does that fully fund schools?
Absolutely not. By the campaign for fiscal equity, the state owes the districts, and especially the urban districts, over $5 billion. Now, the state has a surplus. The governor has been unwilling to raise taxes on people who are at the very, you know, like the top 1%, the top 10%. It would not be that difficult to get through the legislature a reasonable tax structure, but schools are not now fully funded. The inequities in schools, despite what Governor Cuomo says, as I said earlier, New York State has highly inequitable funding, and he talks about he doesn't want to throw more money at the schools. Well, how about throwing some money at the schools in the poorest neighborhoods? One of the findings of international research is that the U.S. is one of the very few nations in the world where more money is spent on rich kids than on poor kids, and it should be the other way around, because rich kids already have the advantages of coming from a home where their parents are college-educated, and they have wonderful, you know, books in the home and conversation and vocabulary that they're constantly exposed to. Poor kids don't have those advantages, so it's the school that we look to try to level the playing field, and the schools can't do it alone.
I'm also wondering, I still, when I was a teacher myself, and I felt that perhaps the most vibrant, notwithstanding money, time of the education system in the city was during the community control of school movement, where regardless of the physical plant where the education was taking place, there was a vibrancy, there was a cultural sensitivity, there was an identification of self and history that encouraged a tremendous sense of learning and stimulation. To what extent is that still, as you would see it, a real major factor that we don't really have and never did realize, that community school principle that was so vibrant during the movement of the 60s?
Well, you know, one could go back even farther to the early 20th century, where there was a very strong community schools movement, and the idea was that the school was open to the community. It served the needs of adults as well as children, and people had a real connection to the community through the schools. And I can't recall the name. There was one guy in East Harlem in an Italian community. Leonard Covello was his name. I did recall it. And he was very much involved in this community schools idea. I think that's important, but we are so far removed from any thoughtful ideas about how to improve schools, because our nation right now is stuck in the No Child Left Behind testing mania. And then, unfortunately, Obama's race to the top just doubled down on the testing. And it's really Obama and Arne Duncan who have promoted this idea that you can judge teachers by the test scores of their students. So that's made the testing even more important because people's lives are on the line, their careers are on the line, their reputation is on the line. And so rather than talk about serious ways in which schools could better serve communities, all we talk about is test scores, and we're judging schools by test scores. And we know that the schools, part of Cuomo's plan that was adopted, and I have to say I'm very upset with the idea that something that's called school reform is part of the budget, because it doesn't make any sense. But part of what he wants that was adopted is the idea that schools would go into receivership, and if they have low scores consistently, then the state will take them over. Well, the fact is that the state has only done that once before, and that was in Roosevelt, Long Island, where it failed miserably, because the state really does not have the capacity to take over schools or school districts and do a better job, and they proved that in Roosevelt. But they want to do it again. And I suspect what he really wants is to take over schools and give them to charter corporations.
Well, Diane Ravitch, we have barely skimmed the surface, but if you are willing, we'd like to have you back more frequently so we can continue to develop that agenda for something so critical, which is really reclaiming our public schools and reclaiming the public narrative around education policy.
Well, thank you. I think that what we really have to do is to begin to rethink this whole education scenario, because what Governor Cuomo has done is to demoralize every teacher in the state of New York, and at some point we're going to become aware that people don't want to be teachers, because it's there's so much demonization, there's so much disrespect for teachers, and it's just a ridiculous scenario. I think the only good thing to come out of all of this is that the public totally rejected his ideas, and yet many of them were passed into law through the budget process, which makes no sense.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Diane Ravitch.
Thank you so much for joining us.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.